First of all, I want to do one follow-up thing on what we talked about yesterday. We were talking about the world, and I flashed up those maps on the screens. Unfortunately, apparently it only showed up over here. But one of the things that I have realized is that probably most of you haven't had geography in a long time. So I'm just going to give you a little quiz. And in this quiz, let me add the missionary kids in the room cannot answer. All right? Yeah. Okay. First of all, if you can tell me the capital of Burkina Faso, stand up. Who can tell me the capital of Burkina Faso? Okay, come on. Everybody knows that the capital of Burkina Faso was Ouagadougou. That should be common knowledge here. All right, so I'll give you a simpler one. Who can tell me the capital of Uzbekistan? Capital of Uzbekistan. Wow, okay. This just demonstrates my point. You guys are appallingly ignorant of geography. I'm going to use the word appallingly ignorant, okay? All right. How many of you can tell me the capital of the state of Kentucky? If you can't, stand up. It is not Louisville. If you can, stand up. If you can tell me the capital of the state of Kentucky. Okay, you guys have a seat. Who here knows the capital of the United States of America? If you can, stand up. Okay, not everybody's standing. This is scary. All right, sit down. My point is this. God cares about the world, and you should too, which means you should know about the world. How many of you regularly access some form of world news? Yeah, the MKs, typically. Okay. So here's my assignment to you. It's a life assignment. Two things. First, get a world map and put it up on your wall. I challenge every one of you to get a world map and put it up on your wall and start studying it. Figure out, you should know where Burkina Faso is. Burkina Faso is a real country in West Africa, by the way. You should also know where Uzbekistan is. I used to live there. I lived there for years, as a matter of fact, and the capital is Tashkent. You should know where these places are, and then you should regularly follow the news and know what's going on around the world. Literally, Americans are the most ignorant people on the planet. It is shameful how ignorant Americans are when it comes to world events and world geography. But that's the setting in which the advance of the church happens. And you need to know that whether you're going to stay here or go overseas, you can only pray about things you know about and you understand. And you need to follow world news and use that as fuel for prayer in your own quiet times and in your churches. And so I would challenge you to get a world map, and then I would also challenge you to make a habit of regularly looking at something like BBC. Okay. By the way, it's not just you, it's America in general, including American news sources. I don't even bother to check like CNN or Fox or any of those because they just cover American stuff. So I would actually encourage you to go to bbc.co.uk. Great source for actually finding out what's going on in the rest of the world. And then turn those things that you read about into sources of prayer. In my intro to missions classes, I begin every class by asking for global prayer requests, and students, it's part of their class participation grade, whether they pipe up or not during that section. And I tell them the way to find out is go to something like BBC, that's British Broadcasting Corporation, bbc.co.uk, United Kingdom, and just find out what's happening. Learn about the strife that's happening right now in Syria, the fact that the Syrian government is shelling its own citizens, and there's a major conflict going on there. Find out when there are floods or earthquakes or famines. Here's one of the things that I can sort of tell you. I cannot officially say that there are missionaries in every country in the world. I can't officially say that. But I can guarantee you that anything you read in the news is affecting missionaries. Anything you read in the news is affecting missionaries, is affecting the advance of the gospel. And one of the things that is most useful in terms of God getting us where He wants us to be is to be people of prayer. And as you start praying about the world, then God will have you where He wants you to move you into place where He wants you to affect the advance of the gospel. So, get to know the world by getting a map, and get to know the world by following world news, and turn what you learn into fuel for prayer. That's a lifetime assignment for you as individuals, and especially for those of you here who have any voice or say in the life of your church, I would encourage you to work on incorporating global prayer requests into whatever venues for prayer there are in your churches. It's said that typical church prayer meetings spend far more time trying to keep the saints out of heaven than get sinners in. I mean, think about it. We have our sick list, and yeah, we pray that God would keep people from dying, generally who are already saved. Well, okay, that's an appropriate thing to do, but when they die, they're going to heaven. What we need to do is to view prayer as literally a wartime activity in which we are serving as the long-range artillery for the advance of the gospel. And we need to engage in prayer in a way that pushes the edges, the boundaries of the advance of the gospel. So that's just my little tirade on that. If any of you come back next year, I would hope that you would, if I asked something like, what is the capital of Burkina Faso, that you'd be able to answer. Now, I happen to see, we joke about this all the time at home, which is why my son was itching to answer that question, but I wouldn't let him. So what I want to talk about today, though, is what do missionaries actually do? Okay, we've laid the foundations of the word in the world. We've talked about how the nations are the major concern, that God intends for His redemptive activity to reach all nations, all peoples, everywhere. We've looked at the world and realized that the majority of the world does not have access to the gospel right now, that the greatest concentrations of gospel witness by far are here, and there are vast areas of need, that there are not only unreached people groups, but there are unengaged unreached people groups whom no one is trying to reach with the gospel. So a missionary is getting ready to go to the field. What do they do? And I want to walk you through some of the major elements of missions strategy today. First of all, let me just justify, why do we talk about mission strategy? We have to think strategically about mission work for a couple of reasons. One of those is that when a missionary goes to the field, to any field, and that can be a target here in this country or it can be somewhere abroad, the goal, you have a goal. You're trying to get somewhere. And your goal is to finish the task, not just to go and do mission work somewhere. So you have to define that goal and then figure out how you're going to get there. And it's particularly important because in most places, there is a lot more need than there are resources. Anywhere you go, you're going to find stuff to do. You're going to find important stuff to do. You're going to find needs that need to be met. And you need to think, with the finite resources that I have, my own time, the other people who are working with me, in any sort of financial resources, what's the best way I can use those to accomplish the task that God has set for us? You remember we said, okay, let me ask, what is the central task of Christian missions? Making disciples, yes. Okay, remember that was the one command, the one order, the one imperative in the Great Commission. We're there to make disciples. We're to make disciples of all peoples. So if that's our goal, and if making disciples necessarily involves evangelism, discipleship, and church planting, then we need to be thinking strategically of all the things I could do, what's going to lead us into that. We also need to think strategically because we need to look where are the gaps. Again, Kate, an analogy that I heard 30 years ago. If you see 10 people carrying a telephone pole, and 9 of them are at one end, and 1 of them is at the other end, which end do you go to help? You go where the one is, okay? And that's exactly the situation here in the world. So we often get in a mission agency, we'll often get requests of people who want to go someplace where they've become aware that there's an opportunity or a need. But looking at the global picture, we'll say, well, yeah, but there are already 9 people there, and there's no one over here. With limited resources, we'd actually much rather you go over here and go where the needs are greater. And so part of the task of thinking strategically with missions is looking where the gaps are. Where are there holes? Where is nothing happening? Where is no one being reached? And prioritizing places like that. Now, that has actually made some people a little miffed at the International Mission Board. I don't even know. How many of you are members of Baptist churches? Okay, how many of you are members of churches that are not Baptist churches? Okay. So some of these things will, my own experiences with the Baptist Mission Board, I can assure you that the things that are typical for us are actually typical for most mission agencies. So these will apply pretty widely. But the IMB, the International Mission Board, began prioritizing about 97, and it's gotten more strict in its prioritization in recent years simply because resources are limited. And therefore, we're sending fewer missionaries to places that have more Christians already and more missionaries to places that have fewer or none. And that's the basic reason why. So you need to define your goal. Remember, the ultimate goal is that the earth be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The ultimate goal is the glory of God. The goal under that gets us there is making disciples of all people groups, so that there are worshipers for Jesus from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. Then we think, okay, how am I going to get there? Working backwards from that, we start thinking about what's it going to take to get to that place. Well, it's going to take churches. It's going to take healthy, reproducing local churches among each one of those people groups in order for us to get there. So then you ask yourself, what's it going to take for us to get those, especially if we're starting from scratch? And that's how you begin to define the things a missionary actually does when he or she hits the ground. Now, the beginning process then is actually one of research. There is a lot of research that goes on when it comes to mission work. One of the interesting moments of my life came. Remember, my region was Central Asia. That includes every country whose name ends in Stan. And that made my life extremely interesting from about 2001 on. I speak one of the Afghan languages. I have been all over Afghanistan. I had personnel all over Afghanistan. Have a good friend in the District of Columbia at Capitol Hill Baptist Church who works for the Defense Intelligence Agency, who once told me that I have a better intelligence network in Afghanistan than he does, because we're there long term. We learn the language, build relationships, and we gather information to help us understand what it is that we need to do. And so you look at a people group and you ask questions like, where are they to be found? What languages do they speak? How do they understand themselves? What's their history? What's their religion? What's their culture like? Who are their friends? Who are their enemies? Who do they relate well to? Who do they want to have nothing to do with? What's the political and economic environment in that place? What's the current status, if any, of gospel witness? Do you or do you not have the Bible or even any parts of the Bible in that language? Is anybody else besides us trying to reach them? Because we never want to waste resources. And so we've had a philosophy for years now of working cooperatively with other evangelical agencies, working together to make sure that we don't duplicate efforts and that we pool our resources in sharing the gospel with folks. Now, there is a lot of resources that are available. Something I would encourage you to look at, it's the International Mission Board website, imb.org. The IMB website has a ton of information, and I'll make references to it several times. But even for you and your church, as you think about prayer, as you think about mission trips, as you think about possibly adopting a people group or anything like that, there's a ton of information that's there. The CIA has a website, and you can get actually a fair bit of information on people groups or countries from the CIA website. There are U.S. government country studies on a number of countries. There's some good news sources. I've mentioned to you already BBC. The best print news source that I know of is also a British publication called The Economist. Now, you may not care anything about economics. It's still a great news source. The first half of the magazine is print articles about stuff that's happening around the world, and it's one of the best ones around. So just a variety of places you can turn to do research about a people group. You check out who else is working, and you talk to them. One of the key things that we tell our people to do, even before they go overseas, is to develop a prayer strategy. One of the things that concerns me about contemporary evangelical Christianity in this country is that it has become way too secularized in its mindset. We act sometimes as though we can learn all we need to learn about how to do outreach from the marketing gurus in Madison Avenue and from popular secular cultural anthropology or pop psychology, and then just develop marketing strategies just like any company, and that will do the trick. Well, my Bible tells me otherwise. My Bible tells me that people who are not saved are a number of things, that they are blind and can't see the truth of the gospel, that they are enslaved to their sin, that they are, in fact, dead in their trespasses and sins. Okay, and I have yet to see anyone come up with an argument clever enough to talk a dead person into being alive again. Any of you? I doubt it. So if someone is merely confused, you can set them straight. If someone is persuadable, you can persuade them. If someone's dead, they need to be raised from the dead. And last I checked, only God can do that, which means that it is fundamentally a spiritual battle. We also are dealing with spiritual realities, with spiritual warfare. Now, I don't want to go too much into this, and I'm certainly not one of those who sees a demon behind every bush, but I do read in my New Testament that we have spiritual opponents that are facing us, and most of us on the mission field have experienced that far more dramatically than people here in this country have. Therefore, the fundamental reality is that this is a spiritual battle, and one of the greatest tools that God has given us in this is prayer. We need to be people of prayer ourselves, and we need to recruit prayer. One of the most important things that you as a church can do right now is to pray effectively, intelligently, and specifically for the advance of the gospel. So I would encourage you, for example, to go to imb.org and look under the prayer tab, and you will find a wealth of resources there that'll help you to know how to pray more effectively. There's a book called Operation World. It's in our bookstore down here. Operation World goes country by country, describes the religious and spiritual conditions of the country, and gives sample prayer requests that you can pray. We insist that even though IMB missionaries do not have to raise financial support, that they have, I think they're now requiring like 100 prayer supporters that you have to have before you go overseas. And then we coach them in how to write effective, regular prayer letters that'll help people to pray more effectively for them. But prayer is a critical dimension to anything that a missionary does. So you can do that right now. You can become prayers right now. You can engage in spiritual warfare on your knees right now as individuals and as a church. And again, once you start doing that, once you start praying for the world, then God's got you where he wants you, and he can move you around. Everybody stand up. Okay. Everybody touch your toes. Okay, everybody stretch high, stretch up, stretch high, stretch high. Okay, sit up. And by the way, Jordan back there is authorized, if anybody falls asleep, to come and slap him on the back of the head, just so you know. He's watching you. Now, for the places that most need the gospel, you cannot go as a missionary. I'm curious, how many of you have a passport? If you have a passport, stand up. Okay, good. All the rest of you, go get one. All right, you can sit down. Not now, but when you get home. Your passport is necessary to go to other countries. Along with a passport, most countries, especially the ones that really need the gospel, require what's called a visa. It means them giving you specific permission to come. It's generally fairly easy to get tourist visas to go most places, but to get residence visas that allow you to go live somewhere is another matter. For the countries that already are most evangelized, you can often get a missionary visa. They will give you a visa to come and live to be a missionary. The problem is all the countries that most need the gospel do not give missionary visas. It's pretty much true across the board. If you think about it, if you remember that map with the places that are dark, where there's very little gospel witness, most of those countries are Islamic, Hindu, Buddhist, or communist, or a combination thereof. And they don't allow missionaries to come in as missionaries. So you have to have some other reason to enter the country. Now, let me be very clear here, because I understand there's some misunderstanding about this. We never tell people to lie. And we absolutely never tell people that they are to conceal their identity as followers of Jesus. Absolutely not. Jesus said, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father who's in heaven. We don't practice subterfuge. However, it is perfectly okay in most places to be a Christian yourself. They just won't let you in unless you're doing something that they think is valuable. So they want you in as a missionary, but as a Christian, an open Christian, you can go in and do something else. So we look at what we call access strategies, ways to get people into countries that don't allow missionaries. Here's where I'm particularly excited that I'm talking to teenagers, because you guys haven't started college yet, and you haven't really started your career preparations yet. Unfortunately, for the places that most need missionaries, the most useless thing you can do is just study theology. I say that because, I mean, I have an undergraduate degree in medieval, Renaissance, and Reformation studies, and a Master of Divinity, and I'm working on a PhD in missiology. So those things just really won't get you most of the places you most need to be. You need some sort of real professional skill that other countries think are valuable. But let me tell you the sorts of things that we have used as ways of placing Christians where otherwise we couldn't get people. We've used quite a number of things in a wide variety of professions. One of the best is sports. I spent my last 4 years in Turkey coaching football, and I actually mean American football with Turkish college students. Oddly enough, pretty much American football only exists in North America, but it's taken off in Turkey for some reason. And there are 30 teams in Turkey. They're awful. I mean, they are so bad. I watched the team play for the first time, came home and told my wife, the only things that they struggle with are throwing the ball, catching the ball, running the ball, kicking the ball, blocking and tackling. Otherwise, they're great. But I took the team. We lost every game the first year I was there. Last year, my last year there, we won every game and were national champions. Because really all it took, I would never be allowed to coach a football team in this country. But over there, I was the automatic genius and got some other people who knew what they were doing better than I did to help me out as well. But all it took was teaching them how to tackle, and they never tackled, so the team that tackles wins. But the cool thing about that as a platform, A, it explained my presence perfectly to people, and B, it gave me and the guys who were working with me amazing access to Turkish college students who literally would give us as much time as we would give them. At any time, if I wanted some people to hang out with, I just had to pick up the phone. I mean, literally day or night. And They actually said to me once, "We know you're busy, but we just want all the time you'll give us." And actually called me Coach Dad, because I was more of a father to them than most of their own dads were. So we've done American football, we've done basketball, we've got people who are doing both baseball and softball. We've actually had some people who have done women's fitness in many Islamic countries. Men and women can't exercise together. So people who have done women's fitness. We had one guy who was a nationally ranked pole vaulter in this country who went and trained with the Kyrgyz National Olympic team. Sports pretty much across the board. The one sport Americans get no respect in for whatsoever is soccer, and deservedly so. The rest of the world is a whole lot better than we are. But otherwise, sports has proven to be an amazingly effective platform for access. Other end of the spectrum, in the city of Istanbul, we have an art gallery. Had some people who are artists. They set up an art gallery, and they are able to reach a segment of the population that my football players and I will never touch. But it's working, and they're having a thriving ministry in the art community in Istanbul. We have a coffee business. It's kind of odd because coffee came from that part of the world originally. But what we discovered is that although Turkish coffee is quite popular there, American coffee is almost like a different kind of beverage, and it's caught on. Our apartment, there were 6 Starbucks within a 10-minute drive of where we lived. Well, so coffee is catching on, and we started a coffee roasting and distribution business. Our workers were basically the salesmen for the business, and they would go out and hang out with restaurant and hotel owners. And in that part of the world, you never just do business. It's a very different culture. And you sit and talk for a while before you get around to the business. And interestingly enough, the two things that are acceptable topics for public conversation there are religion and politics. Those are two things you're supposed to talk about. Now, we tried to avoid the politics because they tended to want to criticize our government pretty quickly. And it doesn't matter who's president. They just wanted to criticize our government. So we would avoid that and get into religion, which was great. And so these guys have had an incredible ministry sharing the gospel, again, with people who otherwise no Christian might ever meet. So we've got business people doing businesses like that. We've done import-export businesses, things like marble. Turkey is a major marble exporter. Persian carpets, all sorts of things, import-export. We've had a bookstore in a couple of places that we've been able to set up. Again, a for-profit business. In much of the world, America gets a lot of respect when it comes to our business know-how. And so we have been able to set up business training as much as anything, helping folks to develop business plans, particularly in the former Soviet Union. Soviet economics was fantasy economics. They just had communism is weird and pays no attention to reality. And after 70 years of communist economics and communist business practices, they've realized they cannot compete with the rest of the world. And so particularly in those parts of my region that were in the former Soviet Union, we found it very popular to set up business training. And by the way, so important is business for the advance of the gospel that here at Southern we've actually developed a new program where you can get it's a cooperative degree program between Southern Seminary and the University of Louisville Business School, where you can get an MBA over there and a Master of Arts in Missiology here, and both programs, that they overlap, and so it reduces the time and the cost to do them, and we show how you can blend business with missionary kind of activity. We've done journalism. We actually have an online travel journal, and people have been able to get journalist credentials to write, and it's all promoting their tourist industries, and so countries have liked that sort of thing. America also is known for its computer skills. We set up computer training programs in various places. We've had people teaching in universities. In many parts of the world, any form of medical training can be useful. Doctors, nurses, physical therapists, occupational therapists. In one place, we've done significant work with blind people and helping basically train blind people how to be self-sufficient. Lots of occupational training, things like that. We've done agricultural development in various parts of the world. There's even a couple of places where we have set up law offices. So God can even use lawyers to spread the gospel. That one stretches the mind just a little bit. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. That in particular actually has been useful in our work with local churches as well. But yes, we have done counseling and therapy, and that has been one of our platforms. Almost anything you can do in this country that is of a professional nature, you can do overseas. Now, things like construction or auto repair, no. Because they have people there who can do those things. But any form of engineering, any form of architecture, any form of medicine, any form of business, any form of sports can be used as a vehicle for the gospel. And here's what I discovered. Okay, I was a church planter in Massachusetts before I went overseas. And I was the Reverend Zane Pratt, pastor of the Baptist Church in Topsfield, Massachusetts, which is a very secularized place. I had to struggle to have contact with non-Christians. I had that identity, and I was sort of held at arm's length. I got to Central Asia and discovered that without that religious identity, doors flew open. And I had far more opportunities to share the gospel, to rub shoulders with non-Christians as somebody with a secular profession than I did as someone with a religious worker kind of identity. So in many cases, we've thought, you know, if they started granting missionary visas, we don't think we'd use them because this is so much better. Again, we're very open about the fact that we're Christians, but we're giving them something that they want. We have an identity that they can understand, and it has opened doors wide open. And I think I mentioned to you, we've gone strictly through this sort of access platform strategy. We've gone from 4,000 to 200,000 believers in 20 years, and none of those people are there as missionaries. So one of the things you do as a mission strategy is to think two things. One, what can be done here? What can be done here that accesses people who otherwise are not going to hear the gospel? And two, who am I? What fits for me? You don't ever want to go do something that is patently, obviously unnatural for you. One of the things we discovered very quickly is that we can't take somebody with a Bible degree and a Master of Divinity and turn them into a businessman overnight. It shows up as phony. And so it needs to be something that you enjoy, something that's clear you know how to do. And we want to have integrity in our platforms. So what we are looking for in terms of the missionaries of the future, the people who are going to take the gospel where it's most needed right now, people who have two full skill sets. One is a full skill set in some secular occupation, be it coaching or business or art or medicine or whatever. And the other is a full skill set in knowledge of the scriptures and the ability to share the gospel, disciple believers, and start churches. And by the way, we do these things not as individuals, but as teams. Hence, we look for teams that have a diversity of gifts. In any given team, we have a personnel strategy. And we think, okay, we're going to put, say, three couples, six people. And in my region, we tried never to put fewer than three couples someplace, but never really more than, say, three or four, just because we couldn't afford to concentrate people too much. But you want to have enough of a team that they are a support network to each other and the body of Christ to each other. But you're going to want somebody there who has the gift of administration. And that may be their primary role. They're the ones who keep up with all the intricacies of keeping your visas up to date and registering your vehicles and doing stuff like that. You obviously want people who have gifts of evangelism. You may have other people who aren't so good at frontline evangelism, but they're great at follow-up and discipleship. You have other people who are just really good at being servants to everyone else and encouraging the folks who are there. You need both men and women. In most, at least of the Muslim world, men can only talk to men and women can only talk to women. Therefore, the women will not be reached for the gospel unless there are women who share it with them, and the men have to have men. Now, I say that. Here's the irony, and I am about to rag on you guys. Would all guys in the room stand up? Okay, ladies, look at these guys. Pray for them. Pity them, but pray for them. Okay, sit down, guys. The reason I say that is that the cry of the mission field is, where are the guys? In my region, single girls outnumber single guys 2-1. That's in places like Afghanistan. What is wrong with you guys? In West Africa, single gals outnumber single guys 7-1. It's one of the hardest places in the world to live, rough conditions. Where are the guys? It is the great need of the mission field is guys willing to step up to the plate and take the gospel into risky places. For some reason, when we announce a difficult mission field, girls line up ready to risk their lives, and the guys are nowhere to be seen. And I don't know what it is. I don't know whether you guys have just all decided to check your manhood at the door or what, but the reality is we need guys. We need guys on the mission field. And we need guys who are prepared to set aside their secular ambitions, but to pick up some godly ambition, to stop floating through life and to be prepared to give their lives for the gospel, to take the gospel where Jesus is least known. When Afghanistan opened up after the American invasion in 2001, I put out an appeal for guys. Actually, I stood right here in the pulpit at Southern Seminary and made an appeal for guys. I got one. But we had a long string of women who were prepared to go into an Islamic country where women have to be completely covered and are regarded as subhuman, where it's dangerous and you can get killed. They were willing to go, and the guys were nowhere to be seen. So I'm just saying, you guys need to step up to the plate, and we need more guys on the mission field. So you've figured out where you're going to go. You've done some basic research on the place where you're going, and you've figured out what needs to be done, what can be done. You've determined an access strategy, a platform, a job, that will enable you to be there, and not just to get permission to live in the country, but that'll have you rubbing shoulders with people in a natural way who have never heard the gospel. You move in, and the first thing you do is learn the language. Okay. If you can speak more than one language, stand up. Well enough to hold a conversation. Okay, you can have a seat. There's a saying that if you speak three languages, you're trilingual. If you speak two languages, you're bilingual. And if you speak one language, you're an American. Most of the world the people just grow up multilingual. I knew people in Central Asia who spoke five or six languages and didn't even think anything about it. We tend to be not so good at this. Here's the thing I want to assure you. You can learn another language. You already speak one of the hardest languages on earth. English is bizarre. It is a weird language. And if you've ever tried to teach English to a non-native English speaker, you know what I mean. Let me give you an example. Okay, what is the standard rule for turning something into a past tense? You add ED to the end. Okay, so keeping that in mind, what is the past tense of run? What is the past tense of sleep? What is the past tense of drink? What is the... Okay, you're beginning to get the idea. What is the past tense of is?
Was.
Not is'd. Okay. All of our most common verbs, every single one of them, are irregular. The rules don't work. And then think about... It doesn't help if you're learning a language as a foreign language. And think about our spelling. I mean, English spelling is an offense against God and the universe. It's just weird. And learning to read English is just hard. So you already know that stuff, hopefully. Hopefully. You don't depend too much on spell check. You know English, you can learn another language, but it is absolutely critical that you do so. And it's not easy. And by the way, okay, those of you who said you speak more than one language, stand up again. Okay? Now, if the language was Spanish, sit down. Okay? If the language was French, sit down. If the language is German, sit down. Okay, let me find out what those other languages are. Okay, you're Turkish. Nepali. Okay. Latin, okay. Romanian, okay. Yes. Okay. And sign language, okay. The Department of Defense has a scale for difficulties of languages from 1 to 4. Okay. Spanish and French are a 1. All right. Turkish is a 3. 4 is things like Mandarin Chinese and Arabic. Okay. So if you've... Now, let me ask another question. Stand up if you have studied Spanish or French in school. Okay. Remain standing if you found the process frustrating. Okay. That's most of you. You can sit down again. The reason I say that is that the worst way you can possibly learn a language is in a classroom. It is the worst way to learn a language. You will not learn a language well immersed in English, studying it in a classroom. Learning a language when you're surrounded by it, learning a language when your ability to buy anything in the local market and thus eat is dependent on your learning it, is a very different matter altogether. And you learn a whole lot faster surrounded by a language, immersed in it, and needing to use it on a regular basis. So please don't be intimidated by that. But it is important that you learn a language. It's important that, and this is what we train people, that you share the gospel with people as much as you're able as you're learning. You don't wait until you're fluent, because then it's just weird. Suddenly you start sharing something you've never talked about before, plus you're out of the habit. And so we have people share the gospel as much as they can, but we do have them learn language. And in the process, we also need to get to know and understand the culture of the people. Okay?
I'm going to pick on you.
Okay. Now, are you uncomfortable right now?
A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit.
Yeah. I'm standing too close, aren't I?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do what you want to do. What would you normally do in a situation like this? Sort of step back, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Where we are right now is normal personal space in much of Asia. So if you and I are holding a conversation, normally this is where we would be. Okay, now take a step back. Take a step back. Okay. So now he's where he feels comfortable. I want you to notice something. His chest is 6 inches from the end of my hand. I knew he would do that because in America we instinctively place our personal space face-to-face in a conversation is arm's length plus 6 inches. All right? That's our culture. But if we're in Asia, okay, he backs up because he feels uncomfortable. I'm an Asian. And by that, I mean a Central Asian. I'm uncomfortable. He's too far away. So I'm going to step closer. And he's probably, if he's not self-conscious right now, he's going to step back again and in about 3 minutes, he's going to fall off the end of his bike. Okay, now, and if we're going down the street and I hold hands with you like this.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yes.
Well, I've heard that.
What are you tempted to do right now?
Let go.
Or slug me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, okay.
These are just the sorts of things that you have to understand and get used to. different cultures view a lot of things differently. We are pretty much all doing something absolutely appalling right now. We have our shoes on inside. That's shocking, okay? And some of you even have, oh, sir, you're cursing me. He's pointing the bottom of his foot toward me, which is, now he's cursing him. Which in many cultures is the equivalent of flipping a bird, okay? Sometimes if anybody has ever done this, this is an absolutely obscene gesture in Turkey. We just sort of do it as an expression of frustration, but it really is the equivalent of flipping a bird in many countries. How many of you are left-handed? Well, stand up if you're left-handed. Stand up if you're left-handed. Okay, you people are just really out of luck. Because, you can sit down again, certainly in much of Central Asia and the Middle East, there's no toilet paper. Instead, there's a bucket of water and your left hand. And that's how you clean yourself. Okay? Therefore, you do not touch another person or food with your left hand. And in much of Central Asia, you eat with your hands. You don't eat with knives and forks. As a matter of fact, the world is almost evenly divided into three parts: those who eat with knives, forks, and spoons, those who eat with chopsticks, and those who eat with their hands. So in many parts of the world, you eat with your hands, and you've got to eat with your right hand. You do not eat with your left hand. Now, has anybody here set their Bible on the floor? If you have, raise your hand. If you set your Bible on the floor, okay. So, you treat the Bible with absolute scorn. You obviously have no respect at all for your own holy book. In many parts of the world, you don't place anything you value on the floor. That's just considered unacceptable. And I could go on and on with things. Things often that you find out the hard way. For instance, we found out when we moved to Uzbekistan that you do not prop a broom up against a wall. That offends some spirit. You have to lie it on the ground. And you never lay two brooms side by side. We wondered if you'd get little whisk brooms if you did. We didn't know. But you're not allowed to do that. I actually went shortly after we moved there and tried to buy my wife a dozen roses, which is a good thing to do, guys. And the flower seller literally turned white. And he said, "You're trying to kill your wife?" Because an even number of flowers signifies death. And therefore, I was trying to curse my wife to death by buying a dozen roses. He wanted to sell me 13, which, of course, my culture says that's unlucky. Then I couldn't do 14. You never go down in number, by the way, guys. Listen to me carefully. You don't get 11. Okay, so I ended up buying her 15. On the other hand, little loaves of flatbread, it's the other way around. For those, an odd number means death. So we were never allowed to buy odd numbers of loaves of bread or even numbers of flowers. And there's just all sorts of stuff like that. You go to another culture, it may all sound really funny to you, but a lot of the stuff we do sounds really funny to them. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about American culture that's just wacko. And once you step outside it, you can begin to see those things. So part of what you have to do is to learn the culture. Now, there are aspects of a culture that are spiritual in nature. Yes, sir?
What if you're born on an odd day?
That doesn't matter. You can't help that. Yeah, you can't help that one. Yeah, you're good. But there are some things that simply don't matter. It really doesn't matter spiritually whether you sit on the floor or sit in a chair. It doesn't matter whether you eat with your hands or with chopsticks or with knives and forks. On the other hand, in Indian culture, in Hindu culture prior to recent years, it was the cultural custom that you burned a widow alive on her husband's funeral pyre. Okay, that's wrong. And there's an area where then the gospel needs to speak in prophetic judgment on a culture. And so part of what you're doing is you're both getting to know the culture and you're beginning to understand in what ways can I simply adapt to the culture with no spiritual compromise, and in what ways do I need to speak against the culture from a biblical perspective. And that is the whole process of contextualization within as you move into an area. So you've figured out where you're going to go. You're learning the language. You're learning the culture. You have some job that allows you to be there and to interact with people. And then what you do is you share the gospel. Within the context of those relationships, you share the gospel. But even there, the more you know the culture, the more you understand how you share the gospel. Because you begin to understand, I can't just talk about God because they don't know who God is. And so I have to explain what I mean by God so that they're not just importing their ideas. For instance, the Islamic idea of God is of someone who is impersonal and distant and doesn't care about you. And I have to correct that understanding of God as I'm going along. Understanding of sin. In many parts of the world, sin is viewed as an entirely external thing. I break a rule. That's all it is. It's just what happens on the outside. And so we have to explain that by sin we mean something deeper than that, that it's a condition of the heart that results in outward behavior. If you go to a Hindu and say you must be born again, they're going to say, oh, that's the last thing in the world I want. Because for Hindus, they're born again and again and again and again. And the goal of Hinduism is to stop being born again, to stop being reincarnated. They don't want to be reincarnated. They want to reach nirvana. And so you need to think not just what do I mean, but what do they understand when I say the words that I'm accustomed to using. And so we share the gospel, but we do so with ever-deepening cultural understanding that enables us to make sure that the meaning and the content of the biblical gospel is what gets across. Now, in the process, then also, we're going to need to work on scripture translation and distribution. I mentioned to you guys last time that within my old region, out of 600 languages, we only had the Bible in 4. And so one of the things you need to do as quickly as possible is get that process going. And that can raise some challenges that you need to think about. For instance, if you're in the tropics somewhere and though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. What if they've never seen snow? So you have to explain things. You have to realize, okay, I've got to come up with some explanations that'll help them. We don't change the text of Scripture when we translate it, but we need to be sensitive to areas that need to be explained. Now, the great thing for us in Central Asia is that Central Asian culture is very, very close to biblical culture. So there are a lot of parables they understood better than we did instinctively, because they're in the same cultural setting. But you work on Bible translation and distribution. A lot of people in the world are illiterate. The country of Afghanistan is 93% illiterate. So you're going to work on getting the text of Scripture recorded in audio cassettes or DVDs or things like that. And also, non-literate people are often really good at remembering and telling stories. And so you think through the stories of Scripture that illustrate the major themes of Scripture. And one of the things we would do is put together sets of Bible stories that go chronologically from creation to Christ. And they could often remember those far better than we could. And so we could not only train people, and I'll explain the gospel, but train people how to share it with others through going through the major events of biblical history. And literally, they could remember the stories verbatim very quickly. Interestingly enough, literacy actually diminishes your memory. It becomes a crutch, and you don't remember things as well once you learn how to read and write as you did before. So non-literate people are often really good at that. These are just, I'm unfortunately going to have to quit here in just a second. As people come to Christ, then you're going to want to disciple them. You're going to want to gather them into churches. We often find that in high persecution areas, people are reluctant to join together in church because they're afraid of each other. They're often more willing to meet with us than they are with other locals because they're afraid that the other local is actually a spy. And there have been some tragic examples where people have pretended to convert in order to penetrate a church, and then they've betrayed all those people to the authorities or to or to the mob for persecution. So these are the kinds of things that are involved in this. But all along, what you're doing fundamentally is being there as a normal person. You are working a job, and on your job, you are modeling the life of Christ and sharing the good news of Jesus. You're living in your neighborhood. Typically, in most parts of the world, other than Western Europe, you have far less privacy than you have here. When we lived in Uzbekistan, I never came home and just found my own family in the house. Half the neighborhood was usually in our house. And so they were watching you. They saw everything that you did. So just as normal life, it's just like you should be doing here, you are displaying the character of Christ in your life and sharing the good news of Jesus with the people around you. And in the process, then, sharing the gospel, discipling believers, and helping them to understand what it means to gather together as churches. That's the life of the missionary. We're going to talk in our final session more about the qualifications for a missionary, what it takes to be one, which is both useful for those of you who are going to be those and for those of you who are in churches that will send missionaries, and we'll end with sort of one more final challenge for you to be missionary-minded for the rest of your life.